Welcome to the 64th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Restoration as Event and Idea, Art in Europe, 1814 to 1820, art historian Thomas Crowe will consider the period following the fall of Napoleon. During this time, artists throughout Europe were left uncertain and adrift, with old certainties and boundaries dissolved. How did they then set new courses for themselves? Professor Crowe's lectures answer that question by offering both the wide view of art centers across the continent, Rome, Paris, London, Madrid, Brussels, and a close-up focus on individual actors, Francisco Goya, Jacques-Louis David, Antonio Canova, Sir Thomas Lawrence, Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres, and Théodore Géricault. Whether directly or indirectly, these artists were linked in a new international network with changed artistic priorities and new creative possibilities emerging from the wreckage of the old. In this first lecture, entitled Moscow Burns, The Pope Comes Home, 1812 to 1814, David, Gros, and Ingres Test Empire's Facade, originally delivered at the National Gallery of Art on March 15, 2015, Professor Crowe describes how key works by David, Gros, and Ingres, fashioned during this tumultuous two-year period, convey the tensions and fissures engendered by the unsustainable character of Napoleon's foundering empire.
Good afternoon. I'm Franklin Kelly, Deputy Director and Chief Curator here at the National Gallery. It's great to see you all here, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Thomas Crowe, who will present this year's A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts with a series entitled Restoration as Event and Idea, Art in Europe, 1814 to 1820. Thomas Crowe is the Rosalie Solo Professor of Modern Art at the Institute of Fine Arts, New York University. He holds an M.A. and Ph.D. degree in art history from the University of California, Los Angeles, and a B.A. from Pomona College. His interests center on the entwined aesthetic and social dynamics in the production of art and the role of art in modern society. His most recent book, The Long March of Pop, Art, Design, and Music, 1930 to 1995, was published by Yale University Press in January of this year. He is also the author of Emulation, David, Drouet, and Girodet in the Art of Revolutionary France, first published in 1995 and again in 2006, also, The Rise of the 60s, American and European Art in the Era of Dissent, 1996, and published again in 2005. Gordon Matta Clark of 2003, The Intelligence of Art, 1999, Modern Art in the Common Culture, 1996, and he was also the co-author of 19th Century Art, A Critical History, in 1994. Professor Crowe has written essays and articles for numerous scholarly journals and is the contributing editor of Art Forum. Professor Crowe's book, Painters and Public Life in 18th Century Paris of 1985, truly transformed our understanding of 18th century French art. It was hailed by critics as, quote, one of the most important books on its subject, an example of the social history of art as it should be written by someone with a deep and extensive knowledge of both subjects, and without question, the most impressive and stimulating study of 18th century French art that has appeared in recent years. Professor Crowe has received numerous honors, including the Eric Mitchell Prize for the best first book in the history of art for the aforementioned Painters and Public Life in 18th Century Paris. In 1987, he was awarded the Charles Rufus Maury Prize of the College Art Association, and he held a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship in 1988-1989. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he is the current recipient of a John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellowship. This past fall, in 2014, he was Michael Holly Fellow at the Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Before his appointment at the Institute of Fine Arts, Crowe was director of the Getty Research Institute from 2000 to 2007. He was the Robert Lehman Professor of the History of Art at Yale University from 1996 to 2000, and from 1990 to 1996, he was professor and chair in the history of art at the University of Sussex. In 2017, Professor Crowe will be the 12th Paul Mellon Lecturer, first at the National Gallery of London with the support of the Paul Mellon Center for Studies in British Art, and then again at the Yale Center for British Art. He will be the first person to have given both the A.W. Mellon Lectures and the Paul Mellon Lectures. That is something very special indeed, and we are honored to have him here today to talk, to present the first of his A.W. Mellon Lectures, the 64th in the series. And the title of his talk today is Moscow Burns, The Pope Comes Home, 1812-1814, David, Gros, and Ang Test Empire's Facade. Please welcome Professor Thomas Crowe.
Well, my great thanks to Franklin Kelly for that warm and generous introduction. And welcome to, to a great occasion in our field, and one I feel very gratified and I hope worthy, but that will remain to be seen in terms of taking my place in such a distinguished line of past lecturers. I'm certainly grateful to the director of the National Gallery and the trustees for this opportunity. Most immediately, my debt is to the dean of the Center for Advanced Study in the Visual Arts, Elizabeth Cropper, the list goes on. I certainly need to thank the associate dean, Teresa O'Malley, who's been a steady and always upbeat guide in all my preparations for these lectures. I want to thank Faya Causey, head of academic programs here in the gallery, for the debt that goes back many years for friendship and support. Haley Plack has been and continues to be the most invaluable liaison. And as Mr. Kelly mentioned, these talks came into being during my time this last fall as a fellow at the Clark Art Institute, its academic program being a sister institution to CASVA. And I was very, very pleased at that point, more than pleased, to be the first of the Michael Holly Fellows, named after the longtime and wonderful director of that program. My own Institute of Fine Arts at NYU, its director, Patricia Rubin, my colleagues and remarkable students have nourished this work in my life in more ways than can be counted. Of the many people who've been essential to what you'll be hearing, most importantly, my wife and best reader, Catherine Phillips, I want especially to mention Mark Ledbury, Mark Hallett, and Cassandra Albinson. So, to the matters at hand, setting the stage for the artistic changes of the post-Napoleonic restoration period across Europe. Change in art is never so accelerated or unpredictable as when forces gather to stop it. Still more when those in authority make a concentrated effort to put things back to some prior state of affairs. The traditional dynasties of Europe, along with their generals, ministers, and sundry advisors, were united in the conviction that the changes effected from the French Revolution in 1789 to the abdication of Napoleon in 1814 had to be rolled back at all costs. The young artist Théodore Géricault created this drawing while serving in a reconstituted royal guard, serving the new monarch, Louis XVIII, scion of the restored Bourbon dynasty. You see him between the columns on the right-hand side of the picture, the rigidly controlled architecture, some emanation of his reconstituted legitimacy. Not quite so obviously obese as he was in actual life. In contrast to the king's precise delineation, however, the elan of the artist's cavalry comrades escapes Jellicoe's powers of precise description, dissolving into a fluid and indistinct mass of half-rendered possibilities, not to mention the rapid calligraphy of the horse and rider in the lower right-hand corner that seems barely more than a ghostly presence. This very mixed and unresolved drawing, I think, can stand for much of what's to come in these talks. More obviously finished works of art mask the disparate fragments from which they've been fashioned. When disruptive events intervene, as they dramatically did around 1814, established formations break apart, and the liberated fragments are released to go their own way, much as they appear to do in the bottom half of Jellicoe's composition. Observing the ways in which these wayward components could then be resynthesized into cogent new works is the closest thing we have to capturing change on the wing. And understanding change is the essence of any history worth the name. Now, the years under discussion in these lectures yielded a remarkable clutch of indisputable masterworks, and these will demand our closest attention. But just as important are works on paper, often small and easily assumed to be provisional or secondary to some grander outcome. The true genius of this historical moment resides, as often as not, in these outwardly unassuming materials, though they reward attention and thought as fully as any monumental painting or sculpture might do. And it's through them that the great dynamic of unmaking and remaking in restoration art becomes visible. Now, to understand what happened to the mind of Europe with the figure of Napoleon removed, I think we ought to start with that figure himself, so as better to gauge the effects of his withdrawal. And as it happens, there is no better single example than the one in this gallery. The portrait by Jacques-Louis David, Napoleon in his study at the Tuileries Palace. And this would appear a consummate image of the ruler's authority and self-sufficiency. Each of his virtues is represented in an allegorical fashion by some pointed accessory within the picture. There is, for example, an edition of the ancient author Plutarch's exemplary lives of the great men of antiquity on the floor. The candles are burnt down to their ends. The floor standing clock reads a pre-dawn hour. The sword belt awaits his striding forth at dawn to review his troops. All these attributes and more interlocked with the precision of a completed jigsaw puzzle. Now, this work takes us back to 1812, at which point Napoleon still brims with confidence at the prospects for his empire. So this is 2 years before the official onset of the Restoration in 1814, and all that disintegration and fragmentation that I've been evoking might have seemed very far away. It may nonetheless be the case that symptoms of Napoleon's collapse can already be discerned in David's portrait of the ruler at the seeming height of his powers. I think we could start making a list of them. Firstly, the time of the painting is out of joint. The emperor appears in his habitual uniform of 1812, adorned with imperial decorations of that same moment. But the task in which he has ostensibly been immersed, the one that viewers are enjoined to applaud and admire, occurred years before. The fiction of the portrait is that its subject had worked through the night drafting the Napoleonic Code. And you see the word code on the rolled paper above the sword hilt in the detail that's up on the screen. That code being his rationalized, democratized body of law intended to apply in every French territory, replacing the unequal patchwork of feudal inheritance. Now, David's fanciful parchment won't tell you that this body of law had been completed by a sizable commission of jurists some years before as a bound volume of over 900 pages, but the scroll seems far more in keeping with the emblematic nature of all the accessories in the picture. And what was more, this colossal legislative achievement occurred before the first consul, Bonaparte, had elevated himself to the station of emperor. So David is tacitly calling attention to that highly contestable self-coronation, further contrasting adherence to republican forms with the currently autocratic condition of the empire. And the implications of such a discrepancy would not for long have escaped the French audience, which brings up a second point. It wasn't intended for a French audience. It was going to where there was no wide respect for republican norms, indeed where the opposite was the case. Napoleon, in his study, did not arise from transactions with the emperor or any of his agents. It's, in fact, highly unlikely that the emperor ever posed for it or even saw the completed canvas. The painting, in fact, came into existence as a transaction entirely outside of official channels, one between David and a British nobleman, the Marquis of Douglas, later Duke of Hamilton, conveyed to the artist from Scotland. Douglas commissioned this portrait of himself from Henry Raeburn in the same year of 1812, bespeaking some perceived correspondence between himself and the current ruler of Europe. The first thing to note is that during the period from Douglas's initial inquiry, which came in the middle of 1811, until the portrait's shipment in November of 1812 and belated delivery to the patron early in 1813, France and Britain were at war, as they had been since the ostensible date of David's scenario in 1804. And not just any state of war. The year 1812 will ring a bell, not only for the onset of America's war with Britain, leading to the burning of this capital, but for the invasion of Russia by Napoleon's Grand Army. The Russians at that point were in fact ostensible allies with France, as were the Russians and Austrians, through whose territory the French forces had to pass unmolested. All of these countries were then part of Napoleon's continental system, and therein lay the source of the conflict. On this map, everything inside of the red line belonged to the network of French territories and alliances comprising this system. Russia, in the green at the upper right, had also agreed by treaty to the same rules. The main condition of alliance with Napoleon's France was maintaining a trade embargo with Britain, the paramount and enduring enemy. Napoleon led his army to Russia in order to enforce that rule. Russia and Britain had before been traditional trading partners, so the embargo was hitting an isolated Russia especially hard. Naturally, the continental system was beginning to leak, and Napoleon wanted it stopped. These circumstances point up a third nested contradiction within David's portrait. Not only was Britain the cause of this catastrophic attempt to police Russian behavior, but Britain was, in early 1812, successfully engaging the French on the ground in Spain under the command of Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington. British-led forces were pushing the French back toward Madrid from a base in Portugal, while the main French army was proceeding far away from the action at the other end of the continent. Absent these pressures and reverses from France's rear in the so-called Peninsular War, the Russian invasion might have gone very differently. Given the appalling losses and profound humiliation visited on French military prestige, which ensued as Napoleon retreated from the enforcement of the anti-British embargo, it might come as some surprise that David was able openly to trade with the enemy over the 1812 portrait of Napoleon. There had been, as might be expected, grantings of exceptions and licenses that made the trade embargo with Britain less than absolute, but nothing so formal entered into David's transaction. As we'll discover in next week's lecture, there was a powerful sense in which the artist could even have been construed as having stolen the ruler's image for his own advantage. The princely sum of 1,000 guineas that David acquired from Douglas. Such a transfer of symbolic capital gave rise to the urban legend of the period that Napoleon had visited David's studio to demand the painting for himself and then kicked it in when the artist refused. Fourthly, if a British patron was seeking from David a celebration of a ruler deemed by the great majority of his countrymen as the virtual Antichrist, exemplified by this detail of James Gilray's famous caricature of 1805, these kinds of assumptions about national identity had been bent to the point of breaking by more than a decade of General Bonaparte, then Emperor Napoleon, scrambling the map of Europe. While Lord Douglas had served the British crown as ambassador to Russia in 1806, he was also very much a Scottish peer. So Scottish, in fact, that he imagined himself the heir to the Stuart dynasty, overthrown in 1688 on account of the Catholic allegiance of James II. And Douglas indeed shared the same confessional commitment and saw himself as the successor, the legitimate successor, to the current dynasty, that is, the mad George III and his wastrel heir, the Prince Regent and future George IV. The Scottish lord had, moreover, been fraternizing with the enemy in Napoleonic Rome around 1804, forging a bond with Napoleon's sister Pauline, the Princess Paolina Borghese, by marriage, who would shortly after advertise her beauty and charisma and carelessness with petty proprieties by commissioning the sculptor Antonio Canova to portray her semi-nude reclining body in the guise of Venus. We can thus detect in David's final effort to secure a plausible totem of imperial authority intimations of the disarray into which it was on the verge of collapsing. Only by a consummate effort of formal discipline is he able to make these seen and unseen fissures cohere into a convincing simulacrum of the man both he and his patron regarded as an incomparable being. The outcome was a sealed, claustrophobic interior packed with abstract, allegorical tokens of what had once seemed a secure and merited European hegemony. as in the rolled map that lies at Napoleon's feet. Nowhere does the outer world make any other sort of appearance. David declared to Douglas, pertaining to their common hero, quote, "Any effort of the imagination must always fall short of reality," end quote. As 1812 wore on, of course, reality became precisely the problem. Ways in which to show the majestic, commanding qualities of Napoleon distributed across the wide sphere of combat seemed to be drying up as the Grand Army suffered one dispiriting reverse after another. Here is the famous graphic diagram made in the later 19th century in which the diminishing size of Napoleon's army is represented in light brown as it moved east from left to right. From its crossing of the Neman River into Russia, the black band on the diagram represents the size and losses of the retreating army as it eventually moved to its pitiful, dwindling destination at the left. There was one artist above all, the consummate battle painter Antoine Jean Gros, who had demonstrated the ability to situate the emperor's exploits and virtues within a plausible sampling of the world in which they manifested themselves. But what would even Gros make of the events of 1812, which were complex and ramified beyond even their military immensity and enormity? Yes, Napoleon's Russian invasion began as a trade dispute, but it's less often remarked that included among the ranks who set out on the campaign were hundreds of seamstresses, embroiderers, musicians, and banquet masters with imperial scepter and robe packed and ready. The emperor set himself up in lavish temporary courts along the way, first in Vienna, where he displaced the emperor, his new father-in-law, from his own palace. And then in Dresden, the Saxon capital, he did the same thing. And it's recently come to light that French expatriates in Moscow were surreptitiously planning a new coronation for which the Pope would again be summoned to preside. Napoleon appears to have had no less an ambition than to recrown himself universal emperor. His largely happy and successful marriage to the emperor's daughter, capped by the birth of a legitimately royal heir in 1811, made the relatively modest, almost bourgeois character of David's portrait seem seriously out of step with the course of empire. Now, as it happened, in the wake of another mutual decimation at the Battle of Borodino in Russia, the French entered Moscow largely unchallenged, next to no Russian troops to be seen. But that same night, the city went up in flames, denying Napoleon both his material base and his imagined capital in the east, looking onwards towards India. Had Napoleon's plans come to pass for making Moscow his gateway to Asia, Gros would have found himself with an entirely different set of tasks before him. In the end, the carriage transporting the imperial paraphernalia for the new coronation was despoiled by Cossacks, one of whom wrapped himself in the emperor's mantle, while Napoleon's imagined capital burned around him. So Gros, denied any grandiose triumph as a subject, returned to the older theme, close to David's the year before, a theme, that is, of Bonaparte as exemplary public servant, bringing the blessings of French humanity to the Russian victims of their own inhumane and benighted leadership. And such is the argument of this large presentation drawing that you've been looking at, nearly a meter across, that Gros produced in anticipation of a painting that he would never be in a position to complete. As the empire unravels and shortly collapses entirely, it is more and more often, as I've been suggesting already, that grand artistic projects never come to realization. So for a history of art of the period, that means that prime material lies in incomplete fragments, studies, sketches, and ideas, which become in their way as complete as any consummated oil on canvas might have been. Gros' Burning of Moscow demonstrates just how compelling and revealing such works can be, far more immediate in their communication than the glaciated surfaces of heavily worked canvases. In Gros' rendering of 1813, the emperor assumes an upright pose of stationary command. Bareheaded, in fact, in very similar uniform to David's ensemble of 1812, Gros adds only the equestrian boots. In the face of the disaster of Moscow, the artist has been forced to resurrect the approachable campaigner, morally obliged to be consternated by the enormity of events, that is, in place of the would-be all-conquering, all-seeing ruler. Attempting to manifest his subject's state of mind in the face of the ruin of his hopes, Gros can really do no better than to turn the emperor's left arm in the opposite direction of his leftward turn of the head, seeming to ward off the supplications of Muscovites who are variously worshiping or defying his authority. The dark lower right, in dramatic contrast, contains the unconverted and the doomed, this defiant pair of captured arsonists in old Russian dress, their spent torches discarded on the ground. Urged forward by imperial guardsmen, one points to the sky as an invocation of the higher power that he follows. At the left, the converted rise from the darkness, one French soldier even reenacting the Trojan hero Aeneas, having hoisted his aged father on his back while leading his son out of the burning ruins. The brightly lit, ecstatically relieved woman who rushes in a leftward counter movement to embrace the trio is qualified in her emotional valence by the two other female figures who create this trio, their frenzied poses enacting some ungovernable release of emotion, conveyed by Gros in a rivetingly expressive rhythm of flailing limbs and hurtling postures, a match for anything in this vein by, say, Fuseli or Goya. On a downward arc is the tragic contrast, an agonized woman kneeling in exhaustion instead of homage over the broken cradle of her dead child on the ground. Surrogates to either side of the emperor take the active parts of offering succor or sounding the rather obvious alarm about the extent of the fires. But what is left for Napoleon to do? He makes a fist with his right hand while pointing over his shoulder at the utterly obvious conflagration, as he appears narrowly preoccupied by confronting the captive miscreants with their crime, something that lowers rather than enhances his air of majesty. Gros uses the buff ground of the sheet to great effect, as aptly described by the artist's first biographer way back in 1868, This writer said, quote, "An immense conflagration lights up the vast scene. An entire city serves to feed these flames, reaching up to the clouds, their illumination equal to the day. So storied Moscow celebrates her own funeral," end of quote. And then this writer adds the historical point. "It was necessary to annihilate the capital of Russia so not to leave any base for the grandiose projects of Napoleon," end quote. And one could say as well that no base was left for the grandiose projects of Gros either. So in light of that observation, it might seem easy enough to condescend toward Gros, poor Gros, stuck in an historical dead end. It won't surprise you to hear that the actual event was also more at odds than usual with Gros' redemptive vision, starving French troops being mostly engaged in looting, while Napoleon himself made a quick exit from the Kremlin gate toward the safety of a nearby country house. But that pathetic reading of Gros' effort and falsifying reading of Gros' effort, I think, would be far too easy. One can't fail to credit the technical brilliance of the Moscow drawing, its interplay of broad tonal passages, which establishes the architecture of lights and darks, against the fine economical use of defining contours touched with judiciously applied white highlights. Gros had every reason to be proud of this sheet, as he was, including it in his legacy to the Louvre. And is it necessarily the case that the internally conflicted pose and expression of his Napoleon, so impinged upon by the more dynamic forces unleashed all around him, represents any sort of failure of resources or imagination? Let's place that isolated figure against another hero, this one from the classical rather than modern repertoire, who also appears pressed by surrounding forces into an internally conflicted outward passivity. This is David's rendering of the first Brutus, the founder of the Roman Republic, fixed at a moment when he reaps the terrible consequences of his patriotic resolve. As we raise our eyes, the procession bearing the headless bodies of his two sons comes into view. These sons had been drawn into a conspiracy to restore the old monarchy. Therefore, under the law put into place by their own father, subject to certain and swift execution. Taking in the entire tableau, their mother and sisters react across the emotional spectrum while the aged nurse hides her face in what reads as the most profound mourning at the very far right. The self-canceling forces of duty and grief render the expression of Brutus likewise one of agonized indecision and ambiguity. To be sure, David's Brutus takes us quite a long way back in time before 1813. Its date is 1789, so nearly a quarter of a century stands between these two figures of stymied heroism. But the Brutus was not only a defining moment in David's career, its making coincided with the very first years in the master's studio for the young Gros, whose close friends were assisting David with major portions of the composition. In moving from David's Napoleon portrait to consideration of Gros's Napoleon in Moscow, it's vital to hold in mind the close emotional bond that existed between them and the deep and lasting imprint made upon Gros by an exemplary tragic work like the Brutus, perhaps the tragic painting of the whole epoch. For all the successes enjoyed by Gros as far and away the most accomplished panegyrist to Napoleon's victories, say, most consummately in the battlefield of Eylau in northern Prussia, maintained even amidst the overwhelming and futile carnage that followed that battle. But Gros shows Napoleon in such performances as playing a purely salvific part, his presence a benediction that transfixes even his enemies, like the blonde braided Lithuanian at the emperor's stirrup. While Gros agonized at requirements in such paintings for documentary veracity and rapid execution had compromised the rigor of his art, I think it really was the suppression of any flaw in his hero that most distanced paintings like this from the tragic standard of history painting as a calling, the turn away from the flawed and tragic dimensions of the hero. In this light, Napoleon tied in knots on the steps of the Kremlin, now the flawed hero, promised the redemption of Gros's whole Napoleonic itinerary as an artist. Imperial failure now securing the very thing that he could never hope to find in themes of imperial success. But the recovered tragedy that he at least touched for a moment in this drawing turned back on Gros himself, as the onrushing restoration of the monarchy meant that no venue or possibility of patronage existed for the tragic vision that Gros had only just recovered for his own large-scale history painting, potentially so, and which left his conception for Napoleon at the burning of Moscow as out of place in time as the portrayal of the ruler by his former master David had been the year before. But it would be a mistake, I think, even to imagine this work as falling short of some prospective realization in oil on canvas. Had that occurred, the greatest part of what makes the drawing so exceptional, most notably its fluid and excitable expressivity of line, would not have survived the transition. Not for the first time, we encounter a consummately achieved work in the guise of something provisional or preliminary. And I think, as we've seen, even when a work appears finished to a T, as is the case with David's Napoleon in his study, that completeness visibly overcompensates for gaps and fissures dictated by the dislocations of the historical moment. And I think much the same can be said of the painting with which I'm concluding this initial lecture. Another work, as good fortune would have it, that is here in the National Gallery, at the moment, in fact, hanging right next to the Napoleon in his study. Its author, J.A.D. Angler, is closely tied to the two artists we've been looking at so far, or three, if we count Géricault. Belonging, as he did, to the first cohort of pupils to enter David's studio, after that first wave to which the young Gros had belonged. Angler won his Grand Prix de Rome in 1801, which would have entitled him immediately to go to Italy to take up his fellowship at the American Academy there, but military turmoil in Italy delayed his taking up residence at the French Academy until 1807. He then stayed on after his three-year fellowship period was over. So at the beginning and at the end of his expected career path, Angra was an artist out of place. Still a Roman expatriate in 1814, the year in which he completed Pope Pius VII in the Sistine Chapel, which you've been looking at. And it is, as you've no doubt observed, a highly finished oil on canvas. But in size, it is hardly larger than Gros' drawing of Moscow burning. The intricacy and precision of detail lends it a lapidary, jewel-like quality, almost like a tempera panel from the 15th century. But the physical size of any painting is something different from its scale. And as with the Gros drawing, grasp of implied scale implies comparison with an earlier landmark painting, all indications being that Ingres had in mind a rivalry with perhaps the largest work on canvas of this entire era. And I mean, of course, David's 1808 Coronation of Josephine, in which the seated likeness of Pope Pius VII in a passive position behind the newly anointed Napoleon crowning his then empress serves as an artistic introduction to this character. In forcibly summoning the physically frail Pope to Paris, Napoleon had been seeking to place his own coronation in the ancient line of Holy Roman Emperors. And then when the coronation was done, Pius VII returned to Rome, but then found himself at dramatic odds with Napoleon when France annexed the Papal States in 1808. Pius VII retaliated by no less a step than excommunicating the French emperor, after which a zealous younger officer, perhaps seeking to imitate the emperor's own lightning improvisations, retaliated by kidnapping the Pope. And Pius VII thus spent the latter years of the empire incarcerated in comfortable circumstances just outside of Paris at the Chateau of Fontainebleau. And there he stayed until early in 1814, when a beleaguered Napoleon, his dreams forfeited, acquiesced in the pontiff's returning to Rome, where he arrived on May 24th, 1814, after having been absent from the Holy See for 5 years. Ingres had begun conceiving his painting by the end of 1812 at the latest, which made his Pius VII in the Sistine Chapel a testament to the absence of the Pope rather than to his presence. Instead of David's memorializing the Pope as ineffectual and subservient to the emperor, Ingres offers this riposte in which the Pope is restored to his rightful position of majesty and deference, the painting rivaling David in conveying ritual gravity, grand spaces, crowds of onlookers. That effect, even enlarged by the abundant personages enlisted into the composition from Michelangelo's renowned fresco decoration of the room. In looking at the painting now, we have to exercise some imagination to see it as it was in 1814, because the whole foreground rank of figures was added decades later. That is, all the figures who were in front of and to the right, just beyond the railing. So if we cut it off a little bit, we're getting closer to what the picture would have looked like at its inception. For his central vignette, Ingres had to rely on a drawing that he had made in 1809, where he had recorded the enthroned Pope, and probably from memory even then, and the Papal Secretary of State, the Cardinal Ercole Consalvi, immediately to his right. Consalvi and other cardinals had likewise been sequestered in Paris, so Ingres really had no opportunities to observe them either. Needing to be on guard against attempting too close a likeness in the case of any of his actors, he emphasizes instead the miniaturized scale of his doll-like personages, along with touches of humor, as with the nearsightedness of the small, portly cardinal near the center, contrasted to the grim concentration of his dark, tall colleague to the right, his right. The Pope's face becomes an expressionless mask. The body made imposingly tall in the manner of a carnival mummer by his long gown trailing down over the base of his throne. Angra confesses that he chose to dress the Pope in white, quote, for the effect of my picture, having no other way to draw the light to him, but nonetheless feels or felt that he remembered seeing, quote, all the dais and himself dressed in that color. Even with the Pope still a captive and the outcome still in the balance between Napoleon and the forces of the old order, Angra the traditionalist seized an opportunity to correct history by placing the absent Pope on the throne once again. He includes a large segment of the baleful left portion of Michelangelo's Last Judgment, the company of the damned, serving as both commentary on the Pope's enemies and warning to any that might emerge in the future, at least in Angra's private imagination. And I think that feature of the painting helps explain why the walls, something's gone a little missing, but this is fine. I think you can, maybe if I go back, sorry. Why the angle of the walls between the fresco and the wall where the throne is seems to be at a wider obtuse angle than 90 degrees. What I think he's attempting to forestall is the Last Judgment becoming too foreshortened and therefore in some way over-distorted and illegible. Because you see how much the straight-on version that I've inserted actually matches the angled version that Angra has painted in a really consummate reduction of the monumentality of the Michelangelo fresco to the proportions of his modest canvas. Angra adjusted the size to proportions suitable for his patron in Paris, but he sharpened its contrarian attitude toward both the Empire and David. Unable to observe his subjects as he painted, Angra's was a wholly imaginary act of restoration. And then, in the uncanny irony of history, Angra writes a letter to his patron announcing the completion of the work almost to the day when the Pope actually comes back to Rome, the actual restoration that Angra had fervently imagined. Now, memory can indeed be a superior resource for art, that is, superior to observed reality. Recalling his attending the ceremonies of Holy Week before the Pope's departure, Angra had written, "There is nothing more impressive than all the ceremonies presided over by the Pope, that good and venerable man, and all the cardinals. I cannot tell you how beautiful it is, how simple and rich at the same time." The music-loving novelist Stendhal, writing in 1817, after all the requisite personnel had been reassembled, painted a different word picture of the same ceremony, though with a backhanded compliment to the artist. So wrote Stendhal, "I have just returned from the famous Sistine Chapel after hearing papal mass, for which I had managed to secure myself the best place available on the right just behind the Cardinal Consalvi. And I may now claim to have heard the celebrated castrati of the Sistine Choir. Never did I, in all my days, endure so demonic a caterwauling." This was the most excruciating cacophony I have encountered these last 10 years, though I found delight and compensation in the manly beauty of Michelangelo's Ceiling and Last Judgment. Refer, then he adds as an addendum, refer to the excellent painting of Monsieur Ingres. So, 1812, Napoleon in his study. 1813, Moscow burning. 1814, the Pope restored to his throne. The sequence of works takes us year by year from the beginning of the end to the actual end of the empire. Or rather, I should be saying, the first of two endings. Napoleon will have his encore, the brief but climactic 100 days in 1815, and we'll be revisiting that episode along with every other figure introduced in this lecture in the weeks to come. But what I hope these cases have conveyed is something of the tensions and fissures engendered by the unsustainable character of Napoleon's empire, which was as much a cultural as a military, political, and economic proposition. The art picks up all of these dimensions. Ingres painted the intended triumph of an old order restored before it had happened, and in the absence of its central subject. Absence is papered over by the heraldic, lapidary, quasi-medieval embellishment of the scene. All three artists found themselves revisiting pregnant moments from their earlier lives to fill in the abysses opening before them. Gros, Burning of Moscow, amplified and multiplied the most extreme vehemence of expression available to him in his existing repertoire as compensation for the irrecoverable loss of the commanding leader and of victory itself. David's construct of Napoleon in 1812 manifests the strain and the unrelenting control he needed to exert over every pictorial element, the tightness of their mutual adjustments leaving no suggestion of free play, no opening beyond its airless confines. This being the price paid by the artist in order to block contrary information pressing in from the world beyond. Of the three main works under examination in this lecture, the two paintings propose an invariant, unchanging reality unaffected by contingent events. They just happen to be completely opposite to one another. In one reality, Napoleon always rules. In the other, he never ruled. The drawing, by contrast, has the capacity to grasp historical change on the wing. The unpredictability and improvisation that made Napoleon's career is there in that work, a necessity soon to be forced on his successors in their attempts to put all the pieces back into place. The root of the word analysis is, in the OED, a breaking up, a loosening, a releasing. In order to understand the complex unity of an artistic talent, we cannot break it up or loosen its moorings ourselves. But we can look to certain moments in history to do that for us. To break obvious, patent, settled formations. And then we can assess how the fragments then behaved and how they could or couldn't be reassembled in order to recover a coherent identity. So for diagnostic purposes, not all periods in art history are created equal. Works generated during exceptional moments of upheaval can tell us more about how art comes together from heterogeneous ingredients, either by the exceptional exertions required to hold them together, or conversely by the failure of such efforts when contradiction becomes too great to be contained by any settled forms. The two artists that we'll add as subjects in the next lecture, because virtually none of the artists to whom you're being introduced are gone, they will have their moments again as the temporal sequence goes forward. Our additions in the next lecture will be the elderly Francisco Goya, and now as a main actor, the neophyte Teodor Jericho. In 1814, both of them arriving at artistic templates that broke the bonds of humanistic precedents, dislodging even the primacy of the human as an adequate vehicle for expressing the violent uncertainties of the coming moment. So, thank you very much for your kind attention.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.